morning and welcome to the July 22nd, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my guest co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Today on Mountain Money, we're going to start by talking about something that is really very much in the news. TJ Sayers, the Director of Intelligence and Incident Response for the Center for Internet Security, is going to discuss Friday's global outage, which apparently is still continuing to some extent, and what we know about the worldwide vulnerability to cyber breakdowns.
Then Christian Bagasa and Manny Vashist of Rebrand Gurus will talk about their business helping businesses reimagine their brands. We'll finish the hour by chatting with Joe Cronley of Edward Jones about the recent moves in the market and what factors may drive the markets going forward. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. So Friday morning, businesses around the world were paralyzed by a global tech outage. Thousands of flights were postponed or canceled, including more than 100 here at Salt Lake International. Some stores couldn't process credit card payments, and there were many other effects. So what caused the outage? How does it relate to other outages that were caused by malicious actors? And what does this tell us about the vulnerability of our infrastructure? We're lucky to be joined this morning by TJ Sayers, Director of Intelligence and Incident Response at the Center for Internet Security, someone I imagine had a very busy day on Friday. TJ, thanks for joining us. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
So TJ, let's start with sort of the big picture. What happened Friday?
Yeah, sure. So basically what happened on Friday was an organization called CrowdStrike, which is a very, very widely used premier vendor for cybersecurity solutions, essentially pushed a configuration update to their sensor fleet. And this company deploys sensors. They're called Endpoint Detection and Response or Endpoint Security Solutions. And it's basically, you can think of it as like a next generation antivirus. So we're all used to having antivirus on our computers. This is the premier version. It's fully managed. It's extremely comprehensive. And it's really the best in business in a lot of ways. And what they did was they pushed a configuration update out to these sensors, and it caused a widespread global IT outage. The sensor was basically creating problems on Windows systems, and it was preventing those systems from booting. People were getting blue screens, which goes by the acronym Blue Screen of Death, which means you try to start your computer and it just won't boot. And so it was a very, very widespread outage. It impacted an enormous amount of systems out there, and it really brought a lot of critical services down. And really in the aftermath, because it happened so early in the morning on July 19th, a lot of organizations were waking up to realizing they couldn't get online, they couldn't access their systems, and especially post-COVID, a lot of us are working from home. A lot of organizations are geographically dispersed all over and never need that, you know, remote connectivity ability. And they just couldn't get online. And the root cause is determined that it was this CrowdStrike sensor configuration update that they did.
Wow. Interesting. Hey, TJ, so when you mentioned the blue screen of death, would that happen at the server level or would that happen with my PC in the back bedroom?
Yeah, so basically what these sensors are is they're usually deployed on endpoints. They can be deployed in other types of infrastructure, but a lot of people were seeing this at server level. They were seeing this on their individual PCs. It really depends where the sensor was deployed.
It's interesting. I guess you don't really think about how important, how central to the cyber infrastructure Windows is, right? Because you think of it as, many of us think of it as something that operates at the PC level and not at the server level. But
right.
I guess that takes me to the next question. CrowdStrike is one company. How can one company's product cause such a big disruption?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So there's two elements here. One is how that technology works, right? And two, how much of a footprint CrowdStrike actually has out in the IT world. So the first element is the way that this technology works that CrowdStrike provides is that it operates with the lowest level privileges, administrative privileges on the systems that it's on. A lot of it is at what we would call the kernel level. So even before the operating system of that system starts, CrowdStrike may be operating at that level. And so any issues at that low level of a system can cause enormous impacts to everything else that that system does. And that's where CrowdStrike works. And that's why it's so effective, is because it's able to monitor such low level processes like that. So you have that element, right? And then the second element is how widely saturated in the market CrowdStrike is. Because they're one of the best in business and because their solution is so effective, they were in pretty much every industry lateral that's out there, from healthcare, financial organizations, travel organizations, IT companies, everything from private sector to federal government. A couple of the estimates out there indicated that they were in upwards of 60% of the 100 Fortune companies out there, right? And this is not just the U.S., this is international. So it's one, you got a really effective solution, and that solution runs really, really low on the operating systems that it's on. And so any issues with that, you're going to have widespread outages and really critical impacts to the systems that it's running on.
My co-host here knows a lot more about computers than I do, and I come from a relatively ignorant perspective. But as I listen to you talking about operating at the kernel level, if we think about my computer as a castle and we think about this as a moat, what I hear you saying is that the CrowdStrike people are deployed as far out as you can get. And that's why if they turn around and turn against you, it really does keep the system from booting. Is that a reasonable way to understand it?
Yeah, you can think of it as, exactly. Think of it as a castle with a moat. And I would say that they operate at the core center of that castle and moat, right? So it's kind of like it's on the most inside perimeter. It's operating at the most intimate, sensitive level of the system and the castle. And so any problems there is going to impact all of the other layers that work on the outside for that analogy.
I like that analogy. That's perfect. And now, is there any indication at all that this was malicious, as in somebody attacked CrowdStrike knowing that they are so deep in the middle of the castle?
Not at this time, no.
Okay.
CrowdStrike is on top of being a very good vendor of security solutions like this, they are also very, very prominent in the incident response world. They have some of the best security practitioners and consultants there is in that space. And from their own internal review and, kind of security community's review, there's no indication that this is malicious. I will say, we have some pretty sophisticated actors operating out there in the world now, and it's not uncommon that initial reviews indicate no malicious activity, but then subsequent findings indicate there was some type of nefarious actions. It's not to say that's going to be the case here, but it'll be interesting what kind of comes out in the next, several months as the investigation goes on and there's additional inquiries into what occurred.
So what I understand that some businesses are actually still affected. Can you help us understand, once this thing is identified, what do you do to try to fix it? What did CrowdStrike do, and what do the businesses have to do?
Yeah, so there's kind of like, there's several buckets here, right? So you got some hosts, meaning hosts as in systems, that were not impacted. So as long as you were running a Mac or a Linux-based operating system, you weren't impacted by this by and large. It was mostly affecting Windows systems. And even beyond that, if you had brought your systems online after, I think, 0530 UTC on July 19th, those systems were not impacted. So we're really talking about Windows systems installed or provisioned before 0530 UTC on July 19th that were impacted. And essentially, the way to remediate those systems is it's kind of all over the place, in the sense of it depends on your infrastructure. There's going to be some cases where you have to be physically present with those systems to manually reboot, reinstall, wipe things away, clean things up to get that system up and running. And then there's other things where you could possibly do some of this remote. The underlying problem is that because of how low this service was on the systems and how widespread the impact is, it's right now a very manual process for the IT community to remediate what happened. So it's taking some organizations longer to get up and running, just because of the size of their organization or because of the availability of IT staff or maybe how dispersed their environment is across the countries. So it's going to be a longstanding impact for many, many weeks as organizations kind of grapple with and try to manually restore some of their assets.
It sounds like the only people working harder than political operatives this week were the IT professionals.
It was a very busy day on Friday, and it persisted over the weekend for most organizations. And it's, as you noted, it's still ongoing today.
Now, if you were going to throw a dart at the dartboard for an amount of money that this, the economic impact that this would cost, what's your ballpark figure? Are we in the tens of billions, hundreds of billions?
Easily in the billions, no doubt. And that's not to say just for CrowdStrike, right? We're talking about all of the industries that were impacted by this, right? Flights were canceled for, most of the day on Friday and potentially into the weekend. You know, you have certain organizations that couldn't provide services for several days. I mean, it's extremely wide and it's global. So yes, definitely in the billions, I would say, if I had to throw a dart.
And the lawyer in me can't resist asking, who's going to be on the hook for this? I mean, does CrowdStrike end up with some liability that I'm sure will pass to insurance companies? Do the airlines have insurance? How do you think this shakes out financially?
Yeah, so there is a thing called cyber insurance. It's cropped up and be much more prominent over the last couple of years, really because of the ransomware space.
Mm-hmm.
But you're speaking specifically to like litigation, and that's a very interesting kind of new territory that's emerging where our company is liable for cyber attacks mm-hmm. or cyber mishaps, right, in the aftermath of an incident of this scale. And we have some good precedent recently for things that could happen, right? So if we think of SolarWinds, folks mm-hmm. may remember SolarWinds. That was a huge IT thing that happened. The SEC actually eventually came out with charges against that organization, and specifically the CISO of the organization. And what they said was that it was not just control failures or failures generally, but it was fraud and internal control failures that were allegedly known to have been there, right? So that's kind of one of the elements we're looking at here is, was it a known problem? Was there known problems when that update was pushed? I think a lot of those elements will play into factor here as the investigation unfolds, but it's very, very, very early and very preliminary to kind of postulate on if they could face litigation of any sort. But it really, I think, will come down to, was it a known problem? Was there any malfeasance, or was this generally just a mistake? And they're going to fix the process moving forward.
Although, again, the lawyer in me just can't let this go quite yet. If I'm a customer of CrowdStrike and I'm sort of paying you to be my moat, right? And then you turned around and attacked me. Have we seen incidents where, in scenarios like this, companies have sued people like CrowdStrike and said, not only did you let me down, you turned against me because you were negligent in doing this update. Have we seen things like that before?
We've seen things like that for sure on the financial front.
Okay.
So like owing people compensation or owing organizations some type of financial settlement because of things that have happened. That was a huge thing too that happened a while ago with the credit bureaus. There was a lot of stuff that happened there where people's information was stolen and whatnot. But a lot of those instances, we're talking about an actual cyber attack
mm-hmm.
that occurred, right? And there was some type of failure to apply certain baseline, reasonable levels of security controls and whatnot. Not necessarily a configuration mistake, right, that was deployed out there. So this is somewhat unprecedented territory, and especially when we start talking about possible criminal, litigation and things like that, I think that's really unprecedented territory, at least for the stuff that we've seen so far.
I think we can be confident that there are plaintiffs' lawyers huddling in conference rooms this morning trying to figure out theories on this, but that's neither here nor there. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, so do you think we're going to see a company called CrowdStrike at the end of this year, or you think they might go under?
Well, I don't want to comment too much on that. Like mm-hmm. They really are the best in business at what they do. They have a great solution. There's other vendors out there that provide similar solutions and are very good as well. But I wouldn't want to comment too much on kind of what this means for them. Everything you can see, it appears that it was a genuine mistake. They have a very good solution. And if they're able to pull through it, I think it would still be a very viable solution that's available to the IT community beyond this year.
You know, from time to time, we hear concerns in our defense industry that there's too much concentration, there are too few vendors. And the same is true with respect to chip manufacturing and other parts of the industry. Does this raise a concern that CrowdStrike has such a big footprint that renders probably an unacceptable risk to critical infrastructure? Are they too big a player? It's the opposite of too big to fail. Are they too big for us to have a risk of failure?
This is a really good point. I'm glad you brought it up. It's actually one of the assessments that the cyber threat intelligence team here at the Center for Internet Security recently assessed was, you know, the expectation essentially that this is going to at least make known that there is a potential soft underbelly here in the global IT community where very sophisticated actors could target a single vendor like this. Right, and affect such widespread damage. Certainly, having a defense in depth approach where you don't just have one security solution being kind of the end all and be all of your security architecture is what we would recommend, right? We want folks to have layered defense, multiple solutions in place. But anytime that you have a single point of entry, right, we think of a lot of times managed service providers or managed service security providers, MSP or MSSPs. Those are very prominent in the space that CIS supports, state, local, tribal, territorial, U.S. governments. Oftentimes, those organizations are targeted because what's viewed is, hey, this one organization could be my stepping stone or our inlet to all of these other companies that they support. So it's not necessarily a copycat effect, but it's kind of one of those things where, it's now known how wide CrowdStrike's customer base was. And if you are a adversary, right, or a malicious actor, you have to be thinking, is there any other organizations out there that are kind of, they have this loving footprint that we could just put all of our resources behind hitting that one target and maybe have an effect and input and damage across all of these other targets that we were trying to hit individually. So our assessment basically was, be on the lookout, right? This has brought to the surface this concern that there is an over-reliance potentially on certain solutions. And it doesn't have to just be security-oriented, right? It could be any type of IT software out there. If it's over-relied upon and it's kind of like a linchpin in the global IT community, that may become much more of an increasing target in the future because of what this has kind of brought to the awareness.
So are we in a world where we believe hostile actors, be it private or governmental, are sitting around sort of assessing, exploring vulnerabilities and trying to develop cyber weapons to possibly seek to cripple U.S. infrastructure or create other kinds of ransom situations? Do we think people are sitting around the table? I talked about plaintiff's lawyers sitting around the table. Do we think hostile actors are sitting around the table this morning?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And not just this morning. This is an ongoing complex problem. That has persisted for many years, where we have everything from state-affiliated actors to activist collectives to organized cyber criminal cohorts are basically trying to keep ahead of the defenders, right? Keep ahead of the security community and target certain organizations. So just like, you know, you would be preparing as a normal business model for, you know, certain endeavors or certain things you want to take on or try to develop or, you know, create a new solution. There's underground communities. There's a whole dark side to that world as well, where they're doing very similar things. Ransomware groups are very prominent for this, right? It's no longer just a guy or gal in the basement with a hoodie over the head, you know, doing some bad stuff online, trying to compromise organizations. These are full-blown criminal organizations or even state-affiliated organizations that are positioning themselves to affect some geopolitical, political, you know, ideological, or even economic outcome to support their larger kind of ambitions in the world.
Well, gee, this can happen to big players around the world. What chance do I have of keeping my home or even small office network secure if they're going after all the big guys?
Yeah, so it's a great point. And what you can take away is you want to try to not be the lowest hanging fruit. So by and large, these really sophisticated groups out there are not interested in individuals like us. They're not interested in hacking your home computer and trying to get stuff off your computer, maybe unless you're the president or some extremely important individual in the world. Usually what we have to worry about is the criminal side of things. And most of that activity is opportunistic in nature, and that's why I say you don't want to be the low-hanging fruit. So basic things like be very careful what you click on, right? Most of the cyber attacks that we're seeing at an individual level come through some type of phishing email, or comes through some type of phone where someone's trying to trick you into giving them information like account passwords, your social security number, things that will give them access to your stuff. So just be highly suspicious, be careful what you click on, and make sure you have things turned on, like the firewall. Every operating system pretty much has an innate firewall that's available. Make sure you have antivirus installed. And also, the biggest thing you could do, too, is back up what you have on your computers. You can buy an external hard drive online, very cheap nowadays. Plug that into your computer, and you can use the built-in utility on your computer to back up your information. So if something does happen to your computer, you're able to restore your information from that backup.
Moving from sort of the individual to the sort of the organizational, as we sort of start to wrap this up, do you believe that appropriate steps are being taken at the state, local, and national level to mitigate risks of particularly hostile as opposed to inadvertent? We know we've seen ransom attacks and other kinds of things. Are the industries and the governments catching up?
Yeah, there's an enormous collective effort being put. What we see is an increasingly hostile cyber domain. So you have federal resources that are aligning. It's been a pleasure for me to see over the last 8 years being at CIS to see how federal entities are coming together. A lot of times in the past, they would butt heads and, you know, there were problems trying to figure out how do we address this thing of cyber. And over the years, that relationship has really solidified. There's a lot of seamless integration and sharing across those organizations. We also see in the SLTT space, there's working groups established. There's ISACs like us, that multi-state and elections infrastructure information sharing and analysis center. There's a variety of other ISACs out there who are trying to help build together this community defense notion, right, where we're all in this together. It's a one team, one fight. There are actors out there who are trying to target what we do, bring down critical services, and we need to work together to kind of combat that stuff. So there's a lot of synchronous work being done across that board to kind of defend against these attacks.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, that's what we dealt with. Now, 8 years over at CIS, what exactly is the Center for Internet Security, and what kind of services do you provide?
Yeah, so the Center for Internet Security is a community-driven, non-for-profit organization. So we're really best known for our critical security controls, or what we call the CIS controls. Those started all the way back with the NSA, and then they moved over to SANS, which is a very premier cyber organization, provides a variety of different training opportunities and things. And then eventually they landed with us. So we focus mostly on best practices. Mm-hmm. So everything from hardening your systems at a very finite level all the way up to policy controls that you can put in to kind of help shore up and secure your systems. And we recently came out, too, with a report called A Reasonable Measure of Cybersecurity. It's really helping organizations grapple with what is actually reasonable, right, for our cybersecurity posture and what is that threshold. And then I mentioned really quickly the MSISAC and EIISAC. Those two parts of CIS, those operate under the umbrella of CIS. Those are specifically geared to helping state, local, tribal, territorial, and U.S. election offices. So we provide a variety of different services that are almost always at no cost to them. Everything from network-level solutions, endpoint-level solutions. We provide cyber budgets. We share indicators. The very robust community-driven model that we have here at CIS.
Gotcha. So if I need a drawbridge repairman, you guys aren't exactly it to keep my castle safe.
No, but if you need to shore up your cyber defenses, we absolutely are.
Awesome.
We've been talking to TJ Sayre, of the Director of Intelligence and Incident Response at the Center for Internet Security. I can't think of anyone that would have been more fun or more appropriate for us to talk to this morning on Mountain Money. TJ, thanks for joining us, and hopefully we can call on you again the next time there's an interesting cyber attack.
Yeah, my pleasure. Keep up what you guys are doing. I really appreciate it, and take care.
We'll be right back after this.
We've all heard the term rebranding, but what does that actually mean? Here to help us understand what rebranding really is and the power that it can unleash for businesses are Christian Bakasa and Manny Vashist of Rebrand Gurus.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good. Thank you for coming, gentlemen.
Good morning, guys. It's nice to be here.
Hey, real quick, what is rebranding? Is it just another instance of branding?
Well, rebranding is actually reinventing yourself in this day and age. Online, whatever we do, we just reinvent ourselves with new technologies, new logos and everything else. And I think that's what rebranding is all about. You know, the world is changing very fast, and in the world of social media and everything, I think rebranding plays the most important role.
Interesting. So social media is part of it, not just my website.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about rebranding is that it's what we consider an omni-channel approach. That means every channel that is available to you, you're able to utilize to create your brand story. And that's where it becomes very important, storytelling.
So that's interesting. I'm visualizing a box or a circle with my company in the middle of it, and a bunch of little arrows coming out of it as the different sort of arenas in which I have to visit. And so if I've got an established brand and I've been doing this for a long time, maybe I was principally a mail order house, I now have to rethink all of those tentacles. Let's go through some of those tentacles. You mentioned social media. What else am I thinking about? My website?
Yeah, and you nailed it right on the head. It's a very much a hub and spoke approach, right? So your business is the hub. Spokes are all the channels that people can come through. You mentioned social media. Social media on its own can have multiple channels. Outside of that, one of the most important is website design and development, being very creative there. You think about it. You see people with wraps on their vehicles all the time advertising their business. They probably drive similar routes all the time. However, if you have a website, you're not just marketing your website to a very specific small location, but you have this massive audience. And then it's using the arms of the website in your SEO, your search engine optimization, to then target specific areas. And you can do that on multiple levels, whether it's a specific town like Park City, or you could go broader into the Salt Lake metropolitan area, or you could go state, countrywide, et cetera. So it's very important to have a very detailed plan and approach to that that's scalable and fits your business. Some businesses are only for small markets. That's all they want to do. But when you do that, you want to capitalize on it very quickly, rapidly, and right succinctly into the audience that you need.
Interesting. So are your clients generally companies, or would you take on a social media influencer or social media personality who does not necessarily have a website but just gets out there on social media?
So great question. Everybody's our client. anywhere you need to go and look at digital recreation is our client. Anybody, whether it's a social media influencer. And I think, you know, for social media itself, I think from the website, it's a very progressive graduation towards doing a mobile application. And I think social media guys and, public speakers, everyone, they want a mobile application. Heck, you guys would need a mobile application if you don't have it already. So I think that's the part of overall digital recreation And that's what Rebrand Gurus does.
So let's take it down a level. Let's do an anonymized case study, mm-hmm. okay? Give us an example of a company that comes to you, not a real company, but a hypothetical company that comes to you. Let's go through the steps you would take to rebrand them.
So first of all, you know, we would kind of approach the person who's basically in charge of the creative work, mm-hmm. whether it's a website or it's a mobile application. We would try to understand the need. You know, the most important part is looking at the longevity, scalability, and complexity of what they are doing. There is a need of the hour, if I may. And then we create, a proposal, so as to speak, and looking at where they want to be in the next 12 months to 24 months, we go ahead and we create that little proposal for them, understand it, you know, hash it out, and basically brainstorm it. Once that piece of paper, which I call a blueprint, is ready, is when we start working. And this is basically reverse engineering. You don't go from zero to 24 months. You basically look at where you want to be after 24 months, and you start from, you know, from then to the day zero. Actually, that's how the process works.
Yeah, one of the key components there is scalability. So most organizations will often look at a website as, hey, this is a one and done thing. And it can be very phase approached so that your business grows alongside with your website and your goals and objectives. So that's extremely important.
So now where are you guys located?
Well, that's a really interesting question. We've had locations all over the U.S. We've been working in the U.S. for about 20 years. In particular, we just recently opened a new office here in Park City. So we're servicing the Salt Lake and Park City area. We saw the potential here with all the recent growth. I live here personally. I've lived here for over 20 years and thought this is a fantastic market. I've worked with Manny for the past 6 years servicing some of my own customers. And when we really kind of sat down and talked about the nuts and bolts, we said, look, I think this is a fantastic market. Let's go after it. So we're right here in Park City.
And let's talk about how you work with Manny and how you, I mean, the complexities of sort of, I know Manny, where are you based, Manny?
So I'm based out of New Delhi, India,
right.
But I've been coming and working in the States side for last 20 years. And I've lived in New York, I've lived in Dallas, I've lived in West Palm Beach, Florida. So I've been, base is out of New Delhi, but yeah, I do work based out of the U.S. market.
So I'm just as a business matter, how do you run an organization that, I take it you have staffing all over the place. Talk to us about how your staffing models work and how you manage to integrate with each other to do an effective job.
Yeah. So our business is really designed to be remote oriented. We have over 85 employees that work for us in everything from engineering through marketing. And we focus holistically on being remote. That's really important for us because all of our services, we focus on being remote. So we have not only the creative digital side of our business, but we also have an arm that's referred to as staff augmentation, where we can fulfill your roles with lower cost staff from remote location. So this is really unique. Anything from a business development or customer support role, all the way through something technical like a JavaScript writer or something like that.
So, let me just put it this way. I act like a bridge between East and West. So, you know, the work gets done out of India, the work gets done out of Philippines, and then the work gets done out of here in the stateside. I basically, I'm the bridge. So, to understand the culture, since I've been coming to this country for the last 20 years, and I was born in India, it's easy for us to kind of make that transition from, you know, from the culture perspective, design perspective, and content perspective. And I think that's where Christian and I kind of go, you know, hand in hand. We shook hands, and that's why this works, you know, beautifully.
And I think the big one is expectation, Roger. We really focus on what is our customer expectation and having the dual threat, per se, of the two of us and our personalities. We really try to be very dedicated to what is their expectation and their need and how do we outperform that.
Mm-hmm. And taking it down, again, another level, you look at a customer comes to you, how do you go about redesigning a website? What are the sort of key things that you see are part of excellent website design?
So there are a number of things to consider, a whole number of things. The largest concern is understanding that we have to build a strategy around the website. So some of the things that can get addressed are, number one, we want to speak to usually the business owner or someone who's highly involved and understands the ideal customer profile. So who exactly are they targeting? That's one thing. The next thing is then understanding the technical side of things, and I'll let Manny kind of touch on that, but let's use Google, for example, the number one search engine. Everybody has to be on Google. There are certain elements of that that you have to follow in order to be predictive and eligible within Google's eyes of presentation. So Manny, go ahead and why don't you touch on that?
I think what's the main goal, you know, for having a website? Return on investment, mm-hmm. You need to reach to the right target audience. I think these are the two goals for any website. So then, like you asked, Roger, you know, we have six big pillars to doing a website. You know, the wireframe, navigation, front-end design, back-end of a website, search engine optimization, ready website, and mobile optimization, which means, you know, everybody uses smartphones. You know, a lot of people just want to see the phones and want to see the beautiful website on a phone. So these are the six pillars of any website now. Once you know your target audience, like Christian said, this sets the tone for the whole nine yards for doing the website.
And Roger, really quick, one of the things that's really important for websites that most people overlook is ongoing maintenance. They have a website built. The website can be serviceable. It can be a fantastic website. But what they don't understand is that there is an ongoing technical support to that. For example, I want to add a new product, or I want to add a price change, or things like that that can be very nominal, color changes, etc. We offer maintenance programs for customers where we provide a subscription model. It's very low cost, but we'll give them an allotted time amount to go in and make changes, et cetera. It's really great.
I want to, Kevin, unless you have something to jump in, I want to talk, just help explain to people a little bit about SEO. Because I think most people have this probably idea that if I type something into Google, what pops up is a disinterested, neutral listing of the hits that are most likely to hit. Talk to us a little bit about why that is such a misguided notion, and how do I address that as a business owner?
So, SEO is search engine optimization. However, in the last 2-3 years, SEO is moving into a word called content optimization. Everything is content. You know, Google was bought over by, YouTube was bought over by Google, and now it's not just the written content, it's the visual content, the infographics, the small videos. Look at the way TikTok has come up and grown like multiple folds, and Instagram Reels. So the notion is that, you know, you need to be on number one ranking in Google. However, it's no longer just a written document. It's when you type somebody's name on Google, Roger, you see their videos popping up now. So SEO is nothing but, you know, search engine optimization. So anything that you search on Google, you know, you need to be on top. And what that brings is rankings, and what rankings brings is the traffic. And what traffic brings eventually is business. So the more the traffic, the more the business. And that's what the search engine optimization is. However, people generally stop at the traffic. And they think that, you know, if you have more traffic, you know, job's done. But not necessarily. The job starts when you have more traffic.
Here's the other thing. The Google landscape is changing rapidly. Everybody's familiar with the buzzword AI. Google, mm-hmm. as you'll see right now, is utilizing AI, and AI is bringing highly suggestible items to the very top of the list. So 80% of the hits in Google are usually on the first page of Google. are actually usually within the first handful of listings. AI is actually sub-planning that and predicting this highly valuable item at the top of the list. If you're able to grow your content, et cetera, to the point where Google can start to recognize, include that in that listing, that is where we're kind of heading in the future for a lot of these things. So content management in your SEO strategy is extremely important.
Now, we just had a great conversation with TJ Sayers from the Center for Internet Security. So do we have a seventh pillar from you guys where it is security on the website so someone doesn't hack in, change the price? Let's say I'm selling honey badgers for $50, stuffed honey badgers, and they change them to $3.95 and they clear out my warehouse. Is security part of your world?
Absolutely. Well, navigation and wireframe does include the security part, so it's a part of those six pillars itself. I mean, nothing is without security on the internet. I mean, you're doing e-commerce, you're putting in your passwords, you're paying online, so security then becomes the most important part of the internet. We see the scams happening all across the globe. So, I mean, that's an obvious. So, security is the most important part of the internet right now.
We've been speaking with Christian Bokassa and Manny Vashist of Rebrand Gurus. Tell us your website, so if people want to learn more about Rebrand Gurus, they know where to go.
Well, you can type www.rebrandgurus.com. It's super simple. You know, we are there on every social media as well. You can just type Rebrand Gurus Official for Instagram, for Facebook, and you'll find us there.
Thanks. You can reach us by phone. My number is 435-659-1180. That's 435-659-1180.
Thanks for spending time with us this morning. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you so very much.
Markets over the last couple of weeks have shown some dramatic movements. So what is going on that explains these movements? Where do things stand with factors like inflation, potential Fed rate cuts? Here to give us this perspective is investment advisor Joe Cronley of Edward Jones. Good morning, Joe.
Hey, good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Roger.
Morning, Joe.
Good to be here.
Thank you for coming. Aside from the present inflation, how's the U.S. economy doing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it depends on who you ask, but from my perspective, GDP growth is still happening. It's not growing at the same pace it was a year ago or 2 years ago, but it is still positive. So I would say economically, that's a good sign. And then the same thing with unemployment. Unemployment is still low, hovering around 4%, not as low as it was a year ago or 2 years ago. But still in really good shape, I would say, overall.
And that's here in the U.S. What about over in Europe or Asia-Pacific regions?
Yeah, interesting. Well, we're starting to see some rate cuts in the, you know, on the other side of the pond there, European Union. So that's a sign that inflation is not as much of an issue there, and they're trying to spur some economic growth to, you know, fight the fact that maybe they go into some type of recession. So I think it's a little bit more front and center and kind of front of the windshield for Europe right now. They're maybe a little bit ahead of us in the market cycle.
And again, that sort of leads us to what is the latest thing we've heard on inflation, and where do you see... Jay Powell is probably the most watched man in America as people are trying to figure out where he's going. It's kind of an interesting role for him. Talk to us about where you think things are going on the inflation and rate side front.
Yeah, really good question. I don't have all the answers, but I appreciate the introduction. I do have my perspective.
Right, that's all I want.
The perspective is we feel at Edward Jones that it's we'll have a rate cut before the end of the year and possibly two. And I read this morning that somebody was saying that there's among the market experts, there's a 93% chance built into the market that rates are going to get cut in this next Fed meeting in September. So we'll see.
In the
Fed meeting in September.
And again, what we would expect when you hear that kind of speculation, how much of a rate cut is typical? I know there was a lot of noise a couple of years ago when they did a double increase, right? What is a double increase and what's a single decrease?
Yeah, a single decrease would be a quarter point,
right.
And a double would be half a point. I would say most people have built in like a quarter point both times, and I've also heard that likely that they're going to try to stay away from the election time frame, October, November. So what we're looking at really is kind of September or December, but again, it's kind of just our perspective.
Gotcha. So if we did have a quarter point drop, then the U.S. Treasuries would accordingly drop as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. And the interesting thing about these times is usually you only see rate cuts happen when the economy is struggling, and really we're not seeing the economy struggling. Things have been pretty good, and so we're kind of in some newish territory, I would say. The other thing, go ahead, Roger.
I'm just thinking about what you just said, which is yes, you often see rate cuts when the economy is struggling, but are we in a situation where Jay hit the brakes? Right, we raised rates to try to slow inflation down, and isn't what may be going on is Jay says, okay, inflation is coming down to where I want it to be. I don't need to have these high rates, which are clearly impacting home building and other areas. So, is it unusual to back off the brakes? I think does he see what people are calling a soft landing? Maybe you can explain what a soft landing is.
Well, yeah, maybe we've seen it, maybe we haven't, but the soft landing was to raise rates in such a way that you wouldn't instigate or start a recession. And so the other thing they're trying to do is they're saying that the target is 2% GDP or inflation, and as we're not there yet, and usually you would only see cuts if we were there yet. So we're still above that. So again, we're kind of in some newer territory.
I kind of wondered if he's doing a dynamic that is, we're not there yet, but I think it's going to get there, and I think I have enough confidence in that I might do a rate cut. I mean, I think that might be what's going on.
Yeah, it could be. I was recently at an investment conference, and our chief investment strategist was there, and the question was, how do you think Jay Powell is doing? That was just his opinion. It's not necessarily our firm overall, but he kind of thought, pretty good, given the circumstances over the last four years in particular.
Do you think Jay Powell will make changes after the election? I mean, I know the Fed is supposed to be non-partisan, but do you think he could be influenced by the next president?
We'll see. I mean, I think, yes, it's possible, but the first question is he going to be there to be influenced?
So let's do some big picture. You mentioned you were at a conference where your chief investment officer was talking. Let's talk about some big picture observations. What are some of the things that when he looked in his crystal ball or when you look in your crystal ball that you see coming on the biggest of big pictures in terms of long-term trends?
Yeah. Well, I would say he kind of reviewed the big drivers in the overall stock market. We already talked about the economy. GDP growth is happening, but just at a slower pace. When you look at corporate earnings, yeah, they're still growing. So that's a good sign, a positive thing. And then if you look at interest rates, right now we're not talking about interest rates going up. We're talking about either them staying still where they are or possibly getting cut. So that's more favorable. So if you look at all three of those he was talking about, then yeah, it looks kind of positive in the future given that perspective. As far as other things, a lot of the growth we've seen in the stock market has been kind of consolidated into this Magnificent Seven. The S&P 500 is up through Friday 16%. The NASDAQ is up 18%. That's total return. But the Dow is only up 8% year to date. And three of those Magnificent Seven are in the Dow. The other four are not. And the three are Amazon, Apple, and Microsoft. The other four are not in the Dow, so that's kind of where you get that. So he was thinking that, well, if rates get cut, we're still seeing corporate earnings grow, that we'll probably see more of a broader expansion of this participation in the growth.
And what
a
about
lot of the returns have come in that the Magnificent Seven, and he was saying that we're probably going to see some broader growth across sectors of the market.
Did he talk about housing at all? I mean, obviously, a quarter point is not going to radically change the sort of freeze-up that people talk about in the housing sector, where people are locked into low-rate mortgages. How much of a... Did he talk at all about what the prospects are for housing, or do you have any observations about how much of a rate cut is it going to take to start things really moving again?
Yeah, he kind of touched on it, but not... He didn't speak a long time on that, but I would say that... A rate cut would be good for the mentality of the consumer mm-hmm. and the home buyer and the home seller. A lot of people would like to get out of their home and get into a new place, maybe a smaller place, but they're kind of tied into their current mortgage because it's 3% or 4%.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when you mention rate cut, what rate is being cut and how is that rate used by consumers?
Well, good question. Yeah, so the Fed fund rates cut a 0.25%, so that will make short-term rates come down commensurate with that. But longer-term rates, as far as like mortgages and the 10-year treasury, are kind of more longer-term. And so it's going to take a little bit more momentum than just a short-term rate cut of a 0.25% to have a bigger effect on mortage rates.
So maybe this, term, maybe
15,
this quarter,
30-year mortgages.
Yeah. So maybe this 0.25% is kind of dipping his toe in the water, seeing what's going to happen. Will inflation continue to subside?
I think it'll have more of an effect on the psychology of the consumer, the psychology of the investor, the psychology of the wannabe homeowner.
Nice.
Okay, Joe. Before we go, anything else you want to add?
Other than I'm available, I'm a resource. We strongly encourage that you meet with your financial advisor in these uncertain times. And I don't have all the answers, but we like to pride ourselves in having the right questions.
All right. We've been talking to Joe Cronley of Edward Jones about what's going on in the economy and the stock market. Joe, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Appreciate it, Roger. Thanks, Kevin.
We'll be right back after this.